Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS, and fresh from her jaunt around England like a less gouty Samuel Johnson, I'm joined by pronunciation maven, which is a word I like to say, Thea Leonarditzi. Thea, did you enjoy your holiday?
I did. I had a lovely time. Thank you.
You're looking very healthy.
Thank you. That's what everyone said.
Yeah, that really just means you were looking terribly pasty
exactly,
before you went.
Exactly. I've reached a normal human colour.
Yeah. What did you do?
I attempted to walk from St Ives to Falmouth, which is 100 miles. And I managed about... Well, we attempted to do it in 6 days. You're supposed to take 10 days. And that was... It was ridiculous of us to attempt it because we only managed 60 miles. Not 6 miles.
60 miles. And did you get... You gave up in disgrace.
I got a very sore foot, so...
Oh, my God.
I gave up. It was the gout, really.
The gout. The gout. Yes, you're in there. Did you try any local cheese?
I didn't have any Cornish yarg, if that's what you're...
Do you like a Cornish yarg?
It's okay. There are other cheeses that I prefer. And actually, what I should say is I had a really incredible sandwich. Cheddar and ham sandwich.
And normally you hate cheddar.
And it tasted so much the better for having been in my bag for 20 miles on a very, very hot Cornish day.
This didn't mean nothing. You were just hungry.
Even the wilted lettuce.
Yeah, this is just you being hungry. Now, us talking about cheese, it's not just irrelevant burble like normally. We do have a cheese section of the podcast today, in your honour.
It was not weekly, just today.
It feels like weekly sometimes we talk about cheese, but actually no, just for today you've got a book reviewed on the subject of cheese, haven't you?
Yes.
We will get to that. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, by the way, do Google TLS subscriptions, type pod1 in the offer code section and you can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the Cheesy podcast this week, we have a special in the TLS on European thinkers and have a lead piece on Michel Foucault. To accompany it, Bianca Maria Fontana has reviewed a book originally edited by Foucault of letters written in the 18th century in which aggrieved people demanded that their troublesome relations would be summarily locked up. Bianca Maria will join us to explain more about this superficially attractive arrangement. Just how central was slavery to America's economic development and how useful is it to dwell upon it in the 21st century? Two large questions addressed in Stephanie McCurry's review of Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economics. Was the plunder of black life the driving force in making America great? And in honour of Thea's return, we're going to be talking cheese. Not the American synonym for money, but the actual dairy product itself. Paul Levy has reviewed the potentially superfluous Oxford Companion to Cheese, which is sitting on Thea's desk as we speak back in the office. And we'll be talking, primarily to Thea, I might imagine, about the book. Thea and Levy describes in it, in the review, it's the weakest on cheese politics.
It's a very interesting field.
Is it? We're going to have none of that shilly-shallying here, and I hope we get thoroughly into cheese politics over the next few minutes. Michel Foucault, one of the most influential European thinkers of his age or any other, took a break from writing his epic History of Sexuality to work on an edition of letters he discovered in the Bastille archives. They dated from the pre-revolutionary period and contain requests from citizens to the lieutenant of police to imprison a member of their own family by means of the lettre de cachet. The lettre was a despotic mechanism by which royal authority could bypass normal legal procedures and lead to the indefinite detention of any person for any reason. But these examples didn't involve matters of political intrigue or the Machiavellian wrangling of high state affairs. They were by people trying to settle personal grudges, domestic complaints, in the most brutal of fashions. Imagine, says Bianca Maria Fontana in her review of a new edition of the letters, titled with commendable understatement, Disorderly Families, Imagine living in a country where your domestic conflicts could be solved by having persons troublesome to you swiftly and legally arrested and taken away. It's a thrilling and ignoble thought, and we might all start compiling a list. Bianca Maria joins Thea and me now. Bianca Maria, let's talk about the overall picture presented by the book. What sort of domestic disputes were proposed to be settled by having one of the parties taken away without trial?
Well, most of them are actually, and this is what is striking about the archive, are very ordinary issues that actually could happen in most families. Husbands who'd been deserted by their wives, people beating their spouses up, rebellious children, people who were drunks or had other vices like gambling and wasted away the family money. The really, I think, crucial point is that most of these people resorted to this system, not because they were especially Machiavellian or cruel, but because they had no money to go to court. This, for me as a historian, was a bit of a discovery, because all the cases I knew of were important cases of famous people who had been persecuted for their ideas or their lifestyle. Well, here you can see that most of the people involved were people of rather modest condition who found it easier and sort of cheaper to address themselves to some officer of the police rather than having to go through tribunals that were very costly and slow in their action.
And were these petitions often granted? Do we know how many times people got the knock on the door as a result?
I don't have statistics, but what is clear is, and this is the other fascinating aspect about the archive, is that the police, well, I say police, but these are really sort of functionaries of the executive. You don't have to think of the police in modern terms. These people took a lot of pain to investigate the case. You know, they would talk to neighbors, they would ascertain the facts, they would try to find out what was going on. And actually, in quite a lot of cases, they said no to the request. Obviously, a very special category that I forgot to mention is people suffering from mental illnesses. There was no medical approach to these questions, so the families had to sort them out themselves.
Something that must specifically have been of interest to Foucault, who had by that time already written The History of Madness and The Birth of the Clinic.
Yes, of course. Certainly Foucault and his co-editor, Alain Farge, were interested in the issue because they were interested in the way in which a state could control people in the most intimate and ordinary aspect of their lives.
Well, I'm interested in that point, because what do you think this tells us about the French pre-revolutionary society, that the royal authority could be petitioned in this way in a kind of, to misuse the word, democratic fashion? It was both people of both genders, it was people of quite lowly status, could access what seems like the state's impartial justice system for free. Is there something positive here, or is it slightly more frightening than that?
Well, for free isn't, first of all, let me correct you, whoever was in prison had to be kept at the family's expense.
Okay.
But for free, I think that this, as you rightly say, somewhat democratic approach, it's partly a function of the way in which the justice system was dysfunctional. Justice was to be bought for a price. The legal sort of community had really turned themselves into a very inaccessible caste that served their own interest and tried to profit from their position. So in a way, turning to the king was a way of bypassing a sort of intermediate power that had become particularly dysfunctional.
Sort of cutting out of vast swathes of the bureaucracy and going straight to the king's ear, as it were.
All the letters, as Foucault calls them, were not written by the people themselves. They were drafted by public scriveners who were recruited for the task. But it was a lot cheaper paying them than paying a magistrate.
It's interesting, as I mean, in terms of the form of the book itself, it's interesting how it seems to fit into Foucault's idea of his historiographical method as being archaeological, because he's sort of, it's a gathering and dusting off of bits and bobs, for want of a better term. And it, originally he didn't want to explain or absorb those pieces into an overarching structure, did he? That sort of came on the suggestion of the other editor.
That's what Alessage explains, that originally Foucault really just wanted to publish a letters. And she persuaded him that they needed some kind of framework. And maybe it wasn't an unreasonable sort of demand, because it's quite difficult for an ordinary reader to be plunged in this rather alien universe. But it is true that reading the book now, the framework has aged much worse than the actual content of the letter, because there is a sort of contrived attempt to give a kind of methodological shape to the whole thing, which reflects very much a kind of debates you had in the late 70s and 80s. And right now, historians don't handle those things in the same way. I suppose that the main change is that today, looking into people's ordinary lives and into ordinary persons is considered normal for the historical profession, and even something that gives a lot of useful information. But in Foucault's time, the idea of looking at people as individuals and not as social groups or classes seemed a very, to use the words of one of his critics, populistic approach to the issue.
Is it not? Do you regard that as an improvement? That now we relish, I suppose, the anecdotal and the emotional because they're indicative of broader truths, or do you applaud the trend more towards these sort of personal histories that we have now?
I suppose I do. I realise that the risk is that a lot of history done in this way may end up to produce loads of dribble, just rejoins a kind of curiosity for people's lives that we see in many forms today of observation of celebrities, or simply, it turns into a big kind of TV reality show. But I think it is really very instructive, because it allows us to look beyond the surface of categories and generalizations that may hide some important realities. I mean, I'm not a social historian myself, so I don't practice this kind of history, but I have to confess that as a reader, I greedily eat up everything which is offered to me, which is on this particular register, because I always find that you can get something interesting out of it.
Yeah, and do you get a perspective, though, on pre-revolutionary France, the relationship between people and their sense of the monarch from this? I mean, is it possible to draw a broader historical point here?
Well, you can certainly draw the picture of a very differential society. This is something that is very apparent in the style. I explained before, the letters are written by professionals, and they are written in a very specific mode, which is always the mode of supplication and humble request. So you certainly get the sense of a very differential society. You also get the sense of a society in which money and social status at whatever level is absolutely dominant. In fact, most of the disputes, but I suppose you could say the same thing about family disputes today, are really about money. Yeah. Inheritance, successions, use of family property, and so on. So in that sense, you get the idea of a society which is really clinging to correct behavior, in spite of the fact that lots of things are sort of crumbling away.
Well, it sounds, in any event, you said you ate it up greedily, Bianca Maria. It's a good read, is I suppose the last point to make about this. These are letters that are interesting.
Interestingly, they are. I mean, I say interestingly because you would expect that letters drafted by professional scribblers on issues that in the end are quite repetitive, because there isn't any infinite variety of domestic dispute, but actually it reads like a series of popular novels, because The archive and the information you get on such individual cases is very extensive, and it sort of leaves you in suspension, waiting for what the authorities will decide. And then, you know, you try to imagine the end of the story. Will these people get together again? Actually, I forgot to mention that a lot of these cases ended up, obviously, in some kind of reconciliation. But, you know, you have people who run away abroad, people who marry illegally, people who, and so on. So, you know, paradoxically, you keep reading on because you wonder what's going to happen next.
And in a sense, you must be, you're sort of being asked to judge for yourself, and, you know, you're wondering.
To be the king.
To be the king. And
yes, I think that is inevitable, because even if you decide that you're just, impartial historian, it's impossible not to take side. You know, you read peroration from an indignant husband and you start thinking it must have been a real pain to live with and that his wife was perfectly right to elope wherever it is that she went to, and so on. But in some cases, on the other hand, you really are left in doubt. You know, who's telling the truth? Who's deforming reality? So I think it's actually, for the reader, it's certainly a very good exercise, and also for the reader who's not a professional historian, who doesn't have a strong commitment to the history of the ancien regime.
There's something else there. Well, Bianca Maria, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
I like this idea of history becoming more personal and more emotional and less based on grand theories. I'm not sure, I mean, I'm obviously a disgraceful amateur, but I wouldn't necessarily want to pick up a history book filled with grand theories anymore. I think the idea of individual lives is more appealing.
Mm. Well, and interestingly, in relation to this book, it sounds like it's something that you can read on at least two levels. So you can read it for the human colour of it, and you can also read it and try to fit it into Foucault's work, more broadly speaking. So, you know, insofar as he would have been looking into the overlaps between knowledge and power and how those are built into society. This is knowledge that's sort of built on, you know, I am a husband and I know my wife to have been unfaithful, but, you know, what's your knowledge based on? Your knowledge is based on rumours that you've heard down at the pub or whatever, and then that somehow still becomes...
And what you want the state to do about it.
Exactly.
I think that's interesting. And also interesting that Foucault, I think, who can be a little hard to read sometimes, the notion that he's this very light-touch editor who just wants to say, oh, I'm not going to theorise about this, just here are these letters, just read them.
Exactly.
Well,
and
it sounds like
he has had a model relationship with his co-editor as well, who was a young academic who I think no one had ever really heard of, and he seems to have worked beautifully with her and taken everything that she said on board, and just sounds like
there'll be some letters. We should try and look at the archive of their letters to one another, which may or may not prove to be the case.
Lettre de cachet.
Exactly. You cannot forget how much they took from us and how they transfigured our very bodies into sugar, tobacco, cotton and gold. So said the author Ta-Nehisi Coates in 2015, voicing the idea that the American economic system has its roots in the subjugation and exploitation of slaves. Stephanie McCurry has reviewed a book called Slavery's Capitalism, a collection of essays that seeks to establish what consensus there is around connecting the modern economy of America with its slaveholding past. And some consensus there does seem to be that the slave South was the leading edge of global capitalism. Indeed, that slavery is a kind of personification of capitalism, of the commodification that must take place there, by which people are judged by a purely monetary value. Capitalism, the thinking goes, like slavery, is coercive at its core. There's a clear connection, therefore, between the past and the present. Is this a helpful or useful line of thinking, though? Well, Stephanie McCurry joins Thea and me now. Stephanie, let's start with the premise of the collection, if we may. Why is it important, or is it important, to calibrate precisely the role of slavery in the American economy?
Well, I think one of the things we've known for a long time, but with increasing detail in the recent, say, 10 years, is how much the economy of the slave South and the profits that were generated by it infiltrated or sluiced through the entire national economy of the United States in the first, what I think of as the first republic, say from the Revolution until the Civil War. You know, we've known that for a long time, that politically and economically slavery was crucial to the structural shape, you know, the Constitution and the politics and the shape of political economy in the United States. And in recent years, we've learned in even more detail, you know, where the money came from, where it was invested, where the profits ended up. And, you know, it confirms the view that slavery, or the cotton economy primarily, was no marginal part of American economic development, but a central part of it. And that raises a whole series, of course, of interesting moral and ethical questions about institutions that were implicated in that growth, but who then tried to disassociate themselves from the profits of slavery. So that's one very big part of what this is all about. Insurance companies, banks, institutions like that.
And so what's the book trying to do, or this collection trying to do? Is there an overarching point to this, in order to point fingers, to make the case that there needs to be more of a reckoning with this bloody and disgraceful past?
Well, I don't think anybody in the historical profession would dispute that the United States has a long way to go in reckoning with its past and, you know, the foundational nature of slavery as an institution. And I don't think there are many people who would deny that slavery had a lasting effect, for example, in African-American life into the 20th and maybe even 21st century. The question is the nature of the connection and the nature of the exploitation. So what I would say is that the uncontroversial part is that slavery was, that is a form of political economy and of profit-making and of labor exploitation. Slavery was a social form that was connected to the larger political economy of the United States. But whether its parts were identical to the parts that were emerging, say, in Boston and in New York, and which were dynamic and fully capitalist in the sense that we would now think of it, organized around the exploitation of free labor. So the question is not whether these things were connected, but whether they are the same. The authors of this book are arguing the latter. And moreover, and perhaps, you know, this is a new, very fashionable claim, that what capitalism became in the United States was actually worked out first on cotton plantations with slave labor in the American South. And I think that that's a very unsubstantiated claim.
So where does the Civil War and the emancipation and the Reconstruction that follows, where does that sit in all of this?
Well, that was one of the main points that I was trying to make, because I'm very concerned about the consequences of this. If you're someone like Edward Baptist, who wants to say that what happened on cotton plantations will tell us a great deal about what happens in Amazon warehouses, then obviously what the historian knows has far more portability and possibly relevance.
Is that not slightly offensive? I was reading your criticism of that, really, and I kind of found myself nodding to sort of draw an equivalence between the abuse of slave labor and workers in an Amazon warehouse. Kind of feels a bit facile, doesn't it?
And my point is, how are we ever to grapple with the particularities of not just labor exploitation, but social degradation, sexual violence, all the various particular aspects of slavery, not being allowed to marry, not being recognized as husband and wife, not recognized as mother or father of your children, being forced to have your children sold away from you, perhaps into forced coupling, all the kinds of things that made life so very difficult to even reproduce for African Americans under the conditions of slavery, and which are quite different from the forms of, you know, it's not like life was so easy after slavery, but part of what's going on in this literature is that they created a paradigm in which the Civil War itself becomes a problem to explain.
Is this part of a wider trend, do you think, and perhaps especially when historians are trying to kind of break into a mainstream and perhaps write a book that will have a broader social current appeal? Is the risk that by trying to present these connections, these continuities right back through history, we gloss over the difference, the particularity, and the fact that things are changing or have changed?
Well, this is certainly my view of it. And it is also not a way of escaping any kind of accountability for what emancipation was or wasn't in terms of reconfiguring racial exploitation in the United States. I mean, no, certainly I'm not arguing that it was the end of racism. What I would say is that precisely as you just said, that the historian's job is to attend to these matters of rupture and reconfiguration and new alignment of power. You know, unpredictability and contingency. I mean, the Civil War was a massive wrench. Nobody in 1860 thought that slavery could be ended completely and totally within a short period of time, like 4 years. It was only war and slaveholders' secession that made that even possible. They were the ones who introduced the element of tremendous unpredictability that created this historic opening.
In a sense, the question left hanging is one that you put in the review, which is, if slavery and capitalism were synonymous, then why did capitalism sort of kill itself? Why did it come to an end?
And also, more importantly, what I don't understand, Stephanie, even go back a further stage behind, why is there such a desire to make capitalism and slavery synonymous? Why can't people just say, which seems to me almost self-evident, that slavery had clear capitalistic elements to it, very obviously? But there's no need to make the simplistic statement that the two coincide absolutely.
I agree, and I'm not sure it would happen in Britain, where there's a longer, I think, sort of memory of a left tradition of talking about slavery and capitalism that has this particular kind of connection but different formulation. In the United States, we have that, but it's a much thinner tradition and much more easily forgotten. So one of the things that goes on just at a scholarly level is there's all these claims about this being new. And certainly it's not new in the obvious sense. The debate over the nature of the relationship between slavery and capitalism has been going on since at least Derek Williams, right? So, you know, since the 1940s. So, and in the United States, Eugene Genovese was direct and central to that discussion. So I think part of it is a desire, I think, is a laudable desire to weigh in on the contemporary condition, to make historians relevant to a debate about the legacy of slavery in the United States. And I certainly feel that this is long overdue, far too underdeveloped in the United States. And in that sense, I share that goal. I just don't share this particular approach to that goal.
Well, I do think, Steph, we'll have to leave it there, but I think that the piece is a very good addition and, to a certain extent, revision of that. It's an interesting subject. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an interesting, she raised the question of our relationship to slavery. And I think because slavery in some way predates the empire, we have our own, you know, there's a whole swathe of extra guilt falls our way after slavery. And we accept that ports like Liverpool and Bristol were built on the backs of slavery. We recognise that, but we also recognise that we were early in putting a stop to it. We did put a stop to it before lots of other people. But then we've got all the imperial guilt to come anyway. So our self-lacerating view of history has another target as well. It doesn't feel like slavery is central, and it isn't central to our national identity in the way it must be in America, where there are so many people who are the direct descendants of slaves.
Exactly. And there are so many ways. I mean, we were talking about the idea of a chronicle of continuity versus a chronicle of change. And it's true that there are unavoidable continuities that you'll see. And I think I've mentioned it on this podcast before, Ava DuVernay's documentary called The 13th, about the 13th Amendment and how, basically, to summarise, a disproportionate number of African-American men are incarcerated, and it's sort of an iteration of slavery, a continuation of that. And, you know, these things are very compelling, and that is it's an excellent documentary, but
it's too simplistic.
Simplistic, I suppose, but also compelling and true, and you need to look at it and you need to absorb it. But it's echoes rather than one song or one note.
And it's interesting, we'll have to move on, but it's interesting that we've kind of had the anti-Foucault approach to history raised here. We talked about Foucault's idea that here are some letters from 18th century France. Have a look at them and draw your own conclusions. Mm. Let's not surround it by the scaffolding of great theories about modern relevance. And that's precisely what this Slavery's Capitalism book seems to me to be, a set of slightly unwieldy scaffolding to say, look, there was slavery, let's make it the same as capitalism, and then let's make it the direct link with today. It's almost the opposite approach, isn't it?
Exactly, because you would have to be able to do that. You would have to achieve the impossible, which is to agree on a stable and absolute definition of what capitalism is and what all its central kind of goals and characteristics are, and then the same with slavery.
And we've not managed to do that in this podcast.
Unbelievably, we've not.
We'll do that again. Next week we're solving the mind-body problem, so we're busy then. So 2 weeks' time, we will come up with an absolute definition of capitalism for you.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
What better way to end today's rich pickings than with a generous serving of cheese? The Oxford Companion to Cheese, which recently landed with a resounding thump on my desk, has the whiff, to me at least, of a book well overdue. Stig looks less convinced. Paul Levy, the author and journalist often credited alongside Gail Green and Anne Barr with coining the term foodie back in the 1980s, is here. So Paul, tell us about the book. Let's start perhaps with what it does well.
What it does well is give an historical picture of the development of cheese making in the United States of America.
Well, that sort of cuts us straight to the thing that it also doesn't do so well. I mean, because the book's main flaw, ironically enough, is a dietary one. I mean, there seems to be a lack of variety in terms of perspective.
Yes, it is a little less well informed about cheese making in Britain, and also doesn't seem to have grasped the possibility that cheese making in the UK greatly outstrips cheese making in the United States. It's important not to forget in all this that the expression American cheese normally refers to plastic wrap sliced cheese.
Yeah.
And that's what American cheese is, the sort of plastic cheese.
And everybody knows that Kraft American cheese is this slightly horrible yellow colour.
I think you can drop slightly from that sentence.
Burger cheese you'd put on your burger.
Not even that good, but yes.
I mean, I suppose there's something quite interesting to that point that's expressed in the book's foreword, because we should say that the editor of the volume is American. She's from Vermont, and many of the contributors are American. And in the book's foreword, the question is asked, can we Americans be the saviours of French terroir? I mean, it sounds a bit like when Hollywood interprets the final stages of the Second World War to me.
It does. But it's also important to say, Thea, that the author of the foreword is a cheesemaker in Vermont.
I see.
And is Vermont a place where one can get good cheese?
Of a certain sort, yes. Actually, I'm probably unfair there, since I haven't been to Vermont for 2 or 3 years, and it's probably the variety now is much greater than it used to be.
And it's true that cheese in America now is big business, certainly bigger business than it has been previously. I think you mentioned an article that says that by next year the market will total something like $19 billion.
Yeah, it is an important economic product, yes. It's also true that the quality has improved a great deal. I mean, to say that it's an important product probably misleads a little bit about the quality, because in fact there's loads and loads of artisanal cheese, and as there has been since the 60s, since I can remember eating Laurie Chanel's goat cheese. An awfully long time ago. I mean, 60s or 70s, I should think.
You say the Companion is weakest on cheese politics.
Yes.
What are cheese politics, and does it tell us something more broadly about politics and nation states in general, or is this the politics of rivals in the cheese-making fraternity?
Both, actually, Stig. It's, first of all, the politics of cheese has largely to do with the use of raw or unpasteurized milk in making cheese. This means that the health authorities of each country have more to do with import and export standards than is apparent, and that the politics are dictated quite often by these considerations rather than by financial ones.
And what should, I mean, is the purest form should be raw milk?
Yeah, I mean, raw milk, it makes superior cheese. It's as simple as that.
But that, and that's being slowly pasteurised out of existence, is it?
No, it's coming back.
Yeah, it's. I mean, so you give the example in your piece, the famous example of Stilton, which you will now not really find. You'll buy Stitchelton instead of Stilton if you want.
Yeah. I mean, that's an extraordinary story, in that the people who... Stilton, there was a scare in the... I can't remember when it was now. And the Stilton makers, there were five of them, all invested in pasteurization equipment. It was then discovered that the outbreak of listeria was not connected to Stilton.
Ah.
But it was too late. They had already invested heavily in the equipment, so they were determined to use it, with the result that when it came time to write the specification for the terroir specification, five manufacturers of Stilton saw to it that pasteurization of the milk was featured as one of the characteristics, legal characteristics of Stilton.
So proper Stilton... If I buy something that says Stilton on it, isn't Stilton?
Not really. I would say not really. They would sue me, but I would say not really.
If I put a blindfold on you, Paul, and gave you Stitchelton and Stilton, would you be able to taste the difference?
You can
say yes, because we're not actually going to carry out the test.
sometimes yes, because the Stitchelton, which is made with raw milk and actually is a Stilton but isn't allowed to be called Stilton, because of the European specifications, is usually creamier.
It also tends to be a slightly different colour.
In the way that, if you remember, old-fashioned Stilton used to be.
Are we cheese snobs now, Paul? Because, you know, there's a reference in this book to the slow food movement and the idea that we are becoming more sophisticated once more in our palates. Do you think we are now, let's talk about Britain before we criticise the Americans again, a sort of nation of cheese snobs? I know theories.
Well, I hope we're becoming the cheese snobs, because it's very, very good for the artisans who are making the cheese if we exhibit a little bit of snobbery about their product. And it creates, an increased market for their manufacturer.
Exactly, and the same goes for everything from, you know, beer as well. It's exactly the
absolutely.
Same thing.
And wine.
And do we, because, you know, we do live in a land where farmers markets exist far more than they used to. Have we seen that? Have we seen that increase in a drive for quality?
Yes, huge. We have seen also a wonderful increase in variety. We go to a new cheesemonger that's popped up in Oxford, and every time we go, there seems to be something new.
So even to you, Paul, you're still trying cheeses you've never had before.
Yeah.
After a lifetime of trying cheese.
Yes, absolutely. And we have one made around the corner called Roll Right, which didn't exist, so far as I know, until very recently.
Well, and just around the corner from us, obviously we're very close. The TLS office is just around the corner from Neil's Yard, which is a danger to my salary. But it just... You know, a few metres from there, underneath Bermondsey Arches, new cheese was developed only about, I think,
absolutely.
5 years ago. The Bermondsey Cruncher or Bermondsey Cheddar
oh, yes,
or something
delicious.
Like that,
yes.
Which is delicious. And I think it was made from an old recipe that someone rediscovered.
Yeah.
And hooray, there's another cheese. Stig just looks so sceptical.
I'm fascinated by this. Paul, we're talking about, Thea's just told a cheese that she's a fan of. I'm always keen for this show to give tips to people. But if you could only have one cheese again, Paul, in your life, what would it be?
I think I'd go for a very old and high-quality cheddar.
Oh.
Even though... Cheddar, of course, is a mode of making cheese rather than an actual cheese. There are still some that have the POA, and there are several farmhouse cheddars that and everybody knows what they are. And I think that's what I would choose.
So there are more authentic cheddars than less authentic cheddars.
Oh yes, there definitely are. Maybe one should say higher and lesser quality, but since cheddaring is a way of making cheese, it's a name that applies to an awful lot of sins as well as to an awful lot of
Thea, Paul, I'm going to be honest with you. Thea in previous conversations with me has talked down the cheddar.
I'm not a huge fan of cheddar. There are other cheeses I would prefer to eat. I think if I were going to have one last cheese, I mean, I should probably represent my native Lombardy here and say, you know, Thalidge or something like that. But I think I would actually go for something like a Tunworth. I love a Tunworth.
Yes, it is very good.
I am partial.
I will confess that every Christmas we have an enormous chunk of Stitchleton.
Ah, proper Stilton. Just finally, Paul, just tell us this. Who is buying this book? The Oxford Companion to Cheese. I've seen it on Thea's desk. It's the size of the Bible.
Yeah.
What is it there for, do you think? And does it do that?
Well, it fails to do one really important thing that other Oxford Companions do, such as the Oxford Companion to Wine or the Oxford Companion to Food, and that is it doesn't quite have the last word, that is the authority to settle bets.
And so, well, let's leave it there, Paul. That's quite a damning final conclusion, but it's not quite authoritative enough for your tastes.
It's not quite there.
Okay, Paul Levy, thank you very much indeed. I didn't want to say this in front of Paul, but I had some mini Baby Bell last night.
I bet you didn't. I bet you're just saying that just to incense me.
I did. Okay. In my fridge, because I have young children who like this, there are three types of mini Baby Bell. There's a cheddar one, the original red one, and there's a Gouda one.
Is cheddar and Gouda, are they both in inverted commas?
I don't
know.
I've not explored the ingredients. From an interesting etymology point of view, why is it called a mini Baby Bell when the baby part of it, I think, carries the size argument? Is it a tautology?
Is it a tautology, or does baby refer to the youth of the cheese? Is it supposed to be that it's extremely fresh, young cheese?
Is that right?
Perhaps. I don't know.
Is there a big baby? We don't believe there is a big Baby Bell, do we? Paul Levy was on the phone. He's a world-renowned cheese expert.
I don't think he would have known. I think it would have been beneath him.
Would he have lost respect for me?
He would. If he had any at all, he would have lost it.
And as Paul Levy listens back to this, as I fondly imagine him doing as he eats some Stitchleton, and listens back to this podcast, he's going to think, oh my God, he's mentioned Mini Baby Bell.
I hope you'd also like to note there that I synergised my two main purposes on this podcast to connect you on your pronunciation.
And cheese. I also like the fact, Thea, that this expert, Paul Levy, loved a cheddar, and you are renowned in the TLS office for being anti-cheddar.
I feel it has been overstated. There are other cheeses that I would prefer. And I also love British cheeses.
I love the fact we've just spent 10 minutes talking about cheese. I mean, I like cheese. I mean, everyone likes cheese. But I would eat a Kraft cheese slice.
Well, there is an entry. There's an entry in this companion for cheese aversion, which is a complex dating
like
very
a
far
phobia.
Back. Well, sort of. I mean, it verges on phobia in more extreme cases.
Really?
And people who see cheese as an absolute perversion in it.
Perversion?
It brings them out in hives. It's not an allergic reaction. It's an aversion.
A perversion or aversion?
An aversion.
Oh, I was going to say, perverse cheese, I could start getting interested about. But when it's
that's worrying. Can we end this now, please?
Yeah, let's end it now. That's all we have time for this week before this goes into a very dark and strange place. Our thanks go to Paul Levy, Stephanie McCurry and Bianca Maria Fontana. Do go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the paper, which has another cover drawn by our artist Darren Smith and celebrates European culture. Yes, even in this post-Brexit world, with pieces on Foucault, Benjamin, Pasolini, Camus, Houellebecq, among others. And do tweet this podcast at @FBFM_podcast with your comments and thoughts, and please review us on iTunes. Now, last week, if you recall and are a regular listener, I promised that we would be talking philosophy. I got my dates mixed up like a cretin, but next week we really shall be discussing philosophy with Professor Tim Crane, who, as we know, Thea has promised to solve the mind-body problem. Will he do it?
I think he will. I'm almost sure he will.
There's only one way to find out. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.